The U.S. says North Korean troops are in Russia to aid in the fight against Ukraine. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin called the situation very, very serious. Austin also said that what the soldiers were doing in Russia was left to be seen. White House National Security Advisor John Kirby says the possibility of North Korean troops arriving in Russia is concerning.
We do not yet know whether these soldiers will enter into combat alongside the Russian military, but this is certainly a highly concerning probability.
That's White House National Security Advisor John Kirby. Now, officials from both South Korea and Ukraine say the alliance between Moscow and Pyongyang is growing stronger and evolving beyond transferring weapons. Moscow is working to push Ukrainian forces from its Kursk region while maintaining pressure on its front line in Ukraine. Several billionaires have taken sides in the presidential race, but one of the country's richest men is sitting this one out. Bloomberg's Nathan Hager has more from Washington.
Warren Buffett says he won't back any political candidates. The 94-year-old billionaire made his position known in a statement on his conglomerate Berkshire Hathaway's website. It alludes to, quote, numerous fraudulent claims about his endorsements of investment products and political candidates on social media. The world's richest person, Elon Musk, is backing Donald Trump in this race, while the New York Times reported that Buffett's friend and fellow billionaire Bill Gates gave $50 million to the main nonprofit supporting Kamala Harris. Buffett has backed Democrats in the past, but has not publicly supported Harris. In Washington, I'm Nathan Hager, Bloomberg Radio.
But we're kicking off with a company that is back in the news. No, not Elon Musk and Tesla, although at some point in time, who knows, we might ask him to come and join us. Tesla share price up 12% overnight. We'll have more of that in a moment. But EOH, a company whose share price was 165 Rand in 2016, yesterday it jumped 9% to 1.82 Rand. The interim group chief executive is Marius de la Rey. Marius, it's a long way back to 165 bucks, but at least you made a start yesterday. The market liked your financial results for the year to end July.
Good morning, Alec, and thanks for the opportunity to chat early this morning. Yeah, it's a start, but certainly you've got to start somewhere. So, yeah, we've got a plan. It's relatively simple in terms of the execution of it. We started in June when I took over with, re-rationalizing the business that we had. I mean, I think basically we had a drive to get it fit for purpose. It's well documented, our history and what we've been through over the last 5 years, certainly not since 2016 because the share price still ran a bit after that. But we just felt that we were at a different phase. We had an opportunity to close out two of our big legacy items during the year under review. And so we started with a rationalization of a sort of central group structure that was no longer fit for purposes for the business that we wanted to run. So, yeah, good start, but long way to 160, as you say.
But a lot of us who've been watching EOH from the years of massive corruption, and we can maybe just touch on that a little bit later. We have been told that it's being rationalized, that it's being fixed, that Stephen von Coller came in, got rid of a lot of the crown jewels. You still got a 6 billion rand a year business, so you've got a proper business still there, but you still the interim group CEO who took over from another interim group CEO. When is stability coming to EOH and as a result of that for shareholders?
Alec, it's a great question. I mean, certainly that decision is squarely with the board, and the board will get shareholder approval for those decisions. But I think it's all about phases in time and how we try and trade our way back. I think the share price demise has been a catalyst for a lot of the change. I mean, it's fair to say that there's been shareholder value erosion, and as a result of that, for the first time, we've got a lot of involvement from the board, and we work closely with them in this restructure process. Yeah, so I think the board will make those decisions. I have been here for nearly 5 years, and so was brought in originally by Stephen at the time, so I was quite familiar with that reorganization. You talk about restructure and restructure and restructure. Unfortunately, historically, when we had 900 business units and 277 legal entities, we were saddled with debt. So the corruption was one stream that had to be dealt with, but being saddled with debt, we just didn't generate enough operating profit to pay that debt down. So, for the period under review, that rationalization was largely driven by settling debt. We're quite optimistic that with the cost restructures that we've taken out now, we want to trade our way from here out. We're quite keen still to get the debt lower. We're a services business, so while we have manageable debt, certainly not my preference to have debt in a services business, but yeah, we're strategically not that keen to sell businesses to get the debt down. We're trying to shape ourselves so that we can trade profitably, reduce that debt, and then go into the next growth phase after that.
Whole new dawn. Let's hope it's not a Ramaphoria, but more of a government of national unity. You're changing your name as well. What's the thinking there?
I think the important thing about this is, sort of 5 years ago when the corruption scandal broke, we had no idea what it actually looked like. What did it mean? Who was it? How deep was it? Was it, across lots of businesses, lots of, contracts, et cetera. So we started a journey some time ago where we moved staff contracts and customer contracts out of an entity called Mutombo, which was identified in the ENS investigation as an entity that had some contaminated contracts in it. And so systematically over the last couple of years, we've renewed our staff contracts and we've engaged with new customers using the IOCO brand. So that's been a journey that's been coming for a while. And we just felt that in FY24, it would be a good time with us closing out two really, really large legacy challenges that have been a drag for us for some time, which were the SARS and the Meluketo matters. We settled them with those authorities. That this would be a time to propose to the board that, let's put that chapter behind us and let's forge together as IOCO, which are businesses that have been operating successfully for a period of time, into the technology, landscape that we wanted to. So we proposed it to the board. They were quite amenable to it, but we still have to go through the regulatory approvals, get shareholder approval in November. And then post that, what is important is it's definitely not a light switch change. So anything where we've got commitments in the name of EOH will let down gently and then just sort of turn up the volume on the IOCO brand as we grow. But certainly we've been operating at a customer and a client level as IOCO for some time. So it's not something new.
Maurice Delarey from EOH.
Lots of earnings after the bell. We heard from Tesla. The company reported quarterly profit above estimates, and Tesla projected a slight increase in deliveries for the current year. We got reaction from Tasha Keeney, Director of Investment Analysis at ARK. She told us the report has something for both long and short-term investors.
The letter is very focused on their cost reduction efforts, and that's great for, those short-term concerns. Long-term, we are focused on the future of the company, which is autonomy and robotaxis. So we're seeing higher full self-driving software revenue recognition. That tells us just how useful these active safety features are.
She is Tasha Keeney, Director of Investment Analysis at ARK. Morningstar equity strategist Seth Goldstein says it shows there is still plenty of demand for EVs.
We saw Tesla return to growth with deliveries, and we see Tesla is ramping up its new vehicles. So the Cybertruck is going to be ramping up production, and Tesla is still on track to deliver the new, more affordable vehicle in the early part of next year.
That's Morningstar's Seth Goldstein. Shares in Tesla were up 12% in the late U.S. session. We also heard from IBM. Quarterly sales missed expectations. Overall revenue was up just 1% to $15 billion. Looking more closely, IBM's consulting business was flat. Here's Bloomberg's Anurag Rana.
Bookings are tied mostly to consulting. So, people sign that deal, but over the next 12, 24 months, that converts into revenue. So you're not going to see that $3 billion translate into revenue quickly. It may take some time. But that's also, we think, 70 to 75% of that is skewed more on the consulting side rather than on the software side.
Bloomberg's Anurag Rana. Now, in terms of software sales, those numbers reflect a gain of 9.7%.
Well, we spent a little time bringing you up to date there because both of those stocks are in the BizNews portfolio. Perhaps another one that could be added in time is Famous Brands. Darren Hillier, the chief executive, joins us now. You guys have also been through the mill, Darren. I guess just like EOH a little earlier in the program, you've had your challenges to deal with. In your case, it was a company called Gourmet Burger Kitchen in the UK. Is that now out the system?
Yeah, very much so. Look, yeah, we long gone, and I suppose it is the reputational damage for these things just lives on for a long time. But we're back up and running in terms of post COVID has probably been the biggest challenge, and that's really what triggered the big event at GBK. But yeah, certainly been tough times, and this half has been a very tough time in SA. And I think we're quite comfortable we've got through it as well.
Well, you've been through the fire, and that's got to add a lot of value to the institutional memory if you compare it with people who haven't. Have you done an analysis yet on what the GBK acquisition actually cost you? Forget about management time, but overall on the bottom line.
Yeah, I mean, essentially depends which kind of maths you want to do, because I mean accounting standards are quite different nowadays with IFRS. But I mean essentially, the full purchase price. All we recovered essentially was 50 million from that on the liquidation dividend. So, and we'd taken nothing out at the time. So I mean essentially the full value virtually.
And how much was that?
2.3 billion. I mean, again, depends on how you net up the purchase price, fees, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
You've got to have a go, though, if you're entrepreneurial, and you certainly did have a go there. And COVID, of course, did not give your business either there in the UK or here in South Africa, didn't give you any, or certainly gave you greater challenges as well. Is that now coming out of your issues that you have to deal with?
No, I think, just the recovery from COVID has been slower than we'd hoped generally, I think, across most markets. And that is around the movement of people and just people getting back into their routines, if you want to call it weekends away, holidays, just general movement is good for us. I think we're pretty much back on track now. I think, in some cases we're at pre-COVID levels. I mean, there's still sectors that are not where they were. And I think that's going to be, a much slower burn. So, I would say it's probably back to business as usual now, particularly in the SA context with load shedding having, sort of abated. I think we're back to, almost those pre-COVID levels, but there's definitely some nuances that are not going to be the same.
Did you lose many restaurants because of COVID?
Not directly because of COVID. At the time, I think we did a good job of working with franchise partners. I mean, there was the odd place that had to close because of the nature of the trading area. But I mean, certainly the post-COVID, we've definitely seen some demographic deterioration in certain areas, which have definitely closed some stores where we would probably not have thought we would have closed over time. And I think some of that talks to the governance issues in SA, particularly the local municipality. And I think COVID was a big accelerator of that deterioration, personally, from what we can see. A lot of infrastructure deterioration in that time. So I think that's more the knock-on effect than actually COVID and the actual extended closures itself. That part we actually worked well with. We had restaurants that were closed, in some cases, 6 or 7 months where they were in entertainment areas. And those are fine again. It's just really particular CBDs and a few areas like that where the local governance has declined. So, not directly because of COVID, no.
I ask that because many restaurateurs went bankrupt. I remember an interview with a restaurateur from Pretoria who explained that had it not been for him putting in the investment that he did from his pension, then they wouldn't have had a restaurant anymore, and so he had to use every bit of savings that he had within Famous Brands. Was it easier for the guys to actually survive than being independent?
I'd definitely say it was easier, but I mean, there's franchise operators, as in most, also had to relook their own personal balance sheet. So, again, depending on the balance sheet of that particular operator, they may have had to do a similar thing to the story that you quote. However, it really did depend on a few things. I mean, the one was, did you have insurance of any sort? And that certainly was quite light around the COVID clause, so there was problems there. landlords were probably the biggest factor in this situation. And where you had landlords that understood and had a longer-term view, you probably had less of a challenge. And then where you were able to access TERS at the time, you had lots of opportunity to try and help your business. And I think certainly we as a franchise all came to the party. So I would say that if you were in a franchise network, you probably had a better chance of survival. But again, your personal circumstances were critical. And I mean, restaurateurs tend to not necessarily be very P&L focused. They're quite cash focused. So I think we have also done a good job in the franchise industry of helping our guys understand that a lot better.
Well, it's hopefully ready for liftoff now, because you've been through, as mentioned earlier, the fire. These numbers, although it's not showing anything to write home about, and as you mentioned earlier, it is a tough environment to trade in. And for those who don't know, we're talking about Wimpy, Steers, Debonair's Pizza, and a whole host of other franchise brands. But are you positioned to benefit from a promised uplift in the South African economy at some point in time?
Yeah, absolutely. And we've got no doubt about that. For two reasons, Alec. The one is all the macro factors that we see coming through historically have been good for us. So, interest rates coming off a high, declining fuel price, particularly, our business is quite sensitive to that. The two-pot system, which is new to all of us, we don't know, but I mean, one has to logically say that it's going to make a difference of some sort in terms of the marketplace. And of course, sentiment and the trend being your friend coming together. And then of course, on top of that, just our own personal situation as a business, having still quite a significant debt pile in the business, interest rates coming down as they are, our debt is expensive right now, will just provide, relief for money that we're paying away now unnecessarily. So, there's I suppose two benefits from our side. But we're most confident that consumer income or disposable income will improve. And of course, the food inflation environment in our case is also stable as well. So a lot of those factors do point to reasons for optimism. But in SA, anything can happen, and you have to be ready for it. You can't bank the optimism. You just got to try and find the wave and ride it.
But the 9% increase in the interim dividend must send some kind of a signal. How should shareholders interpret that?
No, I think it does send a signal, particularly given that we were very conservative at year end and we took, I suppose, opposite criticism for having cut the dividend, and definitely looking forward, the factors that I've just explained give us optimism around what we're seeing. And we're seeing some of that coming through in September, October, just as when we did the year end dividend, we could see the pain coming in the 6 months, particularly March, April. Pre-election was very, very tough. And in fact, this interim results is a tale of two quarters rather than a half. There's such a different trend. So, I think we're, as you say, back on track. This was always the kind of growth in dividend that we used to have pre-GBK, really, and pre-COVID. So not a surprise in that sense.
Darren Healy is the Chief Executive of Famous Brands, and lovely talking with him here on the BizNews Briefing.